This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. I'm Bob Moon in New York.
I'm Amy Morris in Washington. The first in the nation primary got the ball rolling. What you need to be watching for in the next primary contests.
I'm Caroline Hepker.
And I'm Roger Hearing in London, where we're looking at results from HSBC amid a massive cost-cutting and the threat of the coronavirus.
And in Asia, can earnings offset fears about the coronavirus? I'm Brian Curtis here in Hong Kong with that story coming up.
I'm Joe Doe in New York, and this week we're looking at one oil company's crusade to stamp out almost all of its carbon emissions.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Bob Moon. We begin today's program with the growing economic impact of the coronavirus in Asia. And for that, we go to our Hong Kong Bureau and Bloomberg Daybreak Asia hosts Brian Curtis and Doug Christner.
Bob, earnings are coming in thick and fast in the Asia Pacific. Now, the numbers are not all that encouraging, with aggregate profits lower than forecast by more than 6%. And it's really kind of hard to imagine the coming quarter's results to be encouraging, given the onset of the viral outbreak in China and beyond. Joining us to make some sense of all of this, where we might be going, is Bloomberg's cross-assets reporter, Eric Lam. So, Eric, let's take a look so far in this earnings season. Give us some highlights, either positive or negative.
Yeah, as you mentioned, we're about a third of the way through the fourth quarter reporting season in Asia. And as you say, the results so far are lagging expectations, both within Asia's MSCI Asia Pacific Index and also in comparison with peers in the U.S. First of all, in Asia Pacific, we've now got almost 500 companies out of about 1,300 stocks that were expected to report for the period. And the aggregate earnings surprise is now almost 10% below the aggregate earnings expectations. So that number is getting increasingly disappointing as we're going along here. And as you mentioned, we're only going to be getting more earnings with still a bulk of those earnings to come over the next month or so. We've got China and Hong Kong expected to have the bulk of their earnings over the next February and March. Now, taking a look at what we've seen so far, the biggest drag or one of the biggest drags on Asia earnings so far, according to analysts, has been Korea. And some of the biggest companies in Korea have had some disappointing numbers. The biggest company of all, Samsung Electronics, they saw some weak numbers. And this is especially surprising because they actually first off started with preliminary numbers that beat estimates, but their final numbers that came in earlier in January actually missed those estimates. They saw their profits sink 38%, and this is blamed largely on falling memory chip prices. Now, elsewhere in Korea, we also saw firms like LG Electronics also reporting a wider loss than expected, and in Japan as well, we had messaging service Line Corp posted a wider operating loss than all analyst estimates, and Shiseido Co., their net income also fell short of projections. And in their case, they're starting to touch on the concerns about the coronavirus in their outlook. They warned that they expect weakness in their sales from the Lunar New Year holiday in China due to the viral outbreak. So far, these earnings given their fourth quarter are not necessarily covering the viral impact, but as we go along here, we're going to see more and more of that.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I would imagine that some of this disappointment is tied to the residual effects of the U.S.-China trade war. And then, as you just indicated, that right now we had the Lunar New Year holiday, and then shortly after, or in the middle of the holiday, actually, then we get the outbreak. And now it's going to be the issue of guidance going forward that's probably going to be more critical for the market than anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. Given the fact that this is fourth quarter results, we're going to be getting a lot of those guidance outlooks from companies as we move forward. And as you say, we're definitely expecting now, it seems almost baked in at this point, that at least for the first quarter, we're going to see a negative impact on China's economy. And that's going to bleed through into supply chains across the region. Some of the impacts that we've seen over the past year with the trade war, that's a fresh headwind from the viral outbreak, and any kind of crimping of production, extending those production disruptions, is only going to exacerbate that situation.
But is it possible that since the truce in the U.S.-China trade war was called kind of in the early part of the fall, that this negative trend, that there might be some mitigation of that in the fourth quarter? Is there a chance we'll see that with the Hong Kong and China earnings coming?
Yeah, that's certainly possible. We did see kind of a calming of waters a little bit, certainly in Hong Kong, taking a look at some of the most recent economic data from Hong Kong over the last month or so. We were seeing some green shoots there, everything from the small business sentiment indicators that just came out earlier this week, as well as recent retail trade numbers and also the export numbers in Hong Kong. Those numbers were all positive for December and January. But as we are discussing, the viral impact is not really covered by those numbers. And the concern is that that kind of washes away any early glimmers of optimism. And certainly from the revised estimates we're seeing from many shops these days talking about their forecasts for China's economy, then the overall sentiment seems to be fairly negative. Now, that said, the stock market seems to be taking that in stride, and we're seeing a little more sanguine lately. We've seen some rebound in stocks in China and Hong Kong. So there is some buying going on.
Eric, thank you very much. That's Bloomberg's cross assets reporter, Eric Lam. I'm Brian Curtis here in Hong Kong, along with Doug Krisner in New York. And you can catch us every weekday for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia, beginning at 7 a.m. in Hong Kong and 6 p.m. on Wall Street. Bob?
All right, Brian and Doug, thank you very much. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, cost cutting and worries about the coronavirus over at HSBC. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Up later in our program, a showdown between Facebook and the IRS. But first, HSBC delivers fourth quarter earnings next week with its massive cost-cutting strategy in focus and worries about the impact of the coronavirus. For more, let's head to London and bring in Bloomberg Daybreak Europe anchors Caroline Hepker and Roger Hearing.
Bob, the question for HSBC is whether the company can deliver revenue growth that is greater than expenses growth, a big challenge even before the corona health crisis.
Well, we're joined by Bloomberg senior EU banks analyst Jonathan Tice. Now, Jonathan, the focus of the fourth quarter results will be the strategic update, a multi-billion dollar restructuring charge. So what are we likely to hear?
Well, HSBC had sort of spent years restructuring, sold businesses in 50 countries nearly, and had returned to a growth phase. And then everything sort of got more difficult again. And they had a new CEO that lasted 18 months. And the interim CEO has begun to put things in place. But their problem is basically they've got some completely underperforming businesses that have been sitting there for 3, 4, 5 years, not being addressed, notably the US, the investment bank, and parts of the European business. So you've got a sort of a growth leg in Asia, where it's very competitive and you need some pretty good focus. And then you've got an underperforming business as well that is delivering revenue growth that's less than cost growth, that's taking up a lot of capital for very little return.
But look, the strategic review was announced last year. I mean, it really was, although you put the context so beautifully, it was actually a real shock to the markets, wasn't it? Suddenly, HSBC, a British associated bank, is sort of going to divest or move very much away from the European business. What do you think we're going to hear about that in these results? The business in France, as you say, but the business in the UK and also the US. Will we get more on that topic?
Yeah, well, what's sort of surprising is that they're going to wrap it all into the 4Q numbers rather than have a separate strategy day. I think that's interesting, but I suspect that's also because they haven't got a kind of incumbent CEO yet. And to that end, I'll be very surprised if Noel Quinn, the current interim CEO, isn't made full-time. And investors will not like that. But they've traditionally stuck with the sort of homeschooled candidates for management. In terms of what we're going to hear, most people are expecting them to sell France. CCF, a bank that they bought 15 years ago, I remember well when they bought it, and people were quite surprised spreading into France. The investment bank, lots of underperformance there, so I think they're going to take a pretty big axe to a lot of businesses there. In the US, I don't think they're going to take a big axe to the US, but the returns are very, very low. And the problem is they're on the East Coast and the West Coast. There's no real synergy. And if you think you're a mid-sized bank trying to compete with the monsters that we know are US banks, it almost doesn't make sense to the strategy, but they can't jettison it.
Okay, the pivot to Asia. Is Asia actually a terribly good place to be pivoting to right now, given the headlines we're seeing day by day? Obviously, that won't be reflected in the results at the moment, but it must be a big thing in their thinking.
Well, what's interesting about emerging markets is when you think about banks, you think about growth in emerging markets. Emerging markets is about loan growth, high cost of risk. When it goes wrong, it goes horribly wrong, but you can charge a lot of money because it's a sort of nascent market. But if you take Hong Kong, you've got margin pressure as serious as you've got in the UK, which is probably the most competitive mortgage market in the world. So is it a good place to do business? Absolutely. Across Asia, I mean, there is growth and there is secular growth. Is there secular growth of more than 0.5% in the UK and Europe for the next 5 years? No. But it is a more developed market. Where they are is a very developed market. Hong Kong is a massive part of their business. There are suggestions that this relations with China have been strained, Huawei being one good example, but that was a big part of the strategy 2-3 years ago, the Pearl River Delta initiative. So they need to backpedal a little bit from that, I think, because we were all focused on that. And I think one of the reasons that we've got back to this point was they introduced, you mentioned earlier, the operating jaws, which is if you look at revenue growth and you look at cost growth, and obviously you need a positive gap between those two. And they began to talk about sort of 1% to 2%. So the market got fixated on that a couple of years ago because we were given that as a number. And they missed and they missed. I mean, two or three of the reportings in the 2018, 2019, shares were down 4 or 5% because the market thought, hang on a second, you've given us this number and yet you're giving me a quarterly jaws of minus 6%. So we started looking at the P&L and then thinking, actually, you're supposed to be an emerging markets bank. Why are your returns so low? It's a bit like Standard Chartered. Their return on capital is incredibly low for a bank that is emerging market. But at least they've got very, very wide positive jaws and they've got higher loan growth.
Look, how much of this problem is about leadership? Because, I mean, you mentioned that you're expecting Noel Quinn to get the nod and that you would, you know, be surprised about that. But we've seen reporting elsewhere, for example, the Financial Times, you know, saying that perhaps it wouldn't be him or that there would be a delay to whether the CEO announcement is actually given. I mean, how much of an issue is it? Also, how much are we expecting it to be Noel Quinn? Because there have also been other sort of notable personnel changes, haven't there, in recent weeks?
Yeah, well, you'd struggle to find a bank more difficult to find a CEO for, because if you think about what I've just told you, you've got a big European business, massive UK presence. You've got Hong Kong and then Asia. And you've got the US. So if you look at the last couple of big CEO changes we've had for UK-listed stocks, they all came from JP Morgan.
Yeah.
So you've got Barclays, who's an investment banker. You've got Standard Chartered, Bill Winters. He was an investment banker. And actually, a lot of the investment bank at Standard Chartered does need addressing. But HSBC, the investment bank is part of it, but you can't hire somebody who doesn't know Asia. So you almost want dual CEOs because you want somebody to overlook the restructuring, but you've got to make sure that you don't disrupt all of the good stuff they've got in Asia. And there is some very decent business in the UK. There's just some business that they shouldn't be in. And in the US, as I say, if they started again, would they have a US presence? Well, they've got to because they're a global bank and they're a global trade bank. But would you put together the banks that they bought and their geographic locations to create that bank to facilitate global trade for US clients or for Asian and European clients into the US? You absolutely wouldn't. So you need somebody who really knows the US banking market. And I've just given you three different people.
Yeah, that's a hard package.
That's the problem.
All right. Well, finally, what about the share price underperformance? Because it's a clear problem. We've seen some very interesting financial results coming out in the last month or so, different from America into Europe. But HSBC, how does it stack up in this field now?
It used to be the core lining in a portfolio. If you didn't want to look at banks, but you knew you wanted to be market weight, and HSBC was the way to do it, that's been supplanted in Europe by a BNP, for example.
Okay. Separating the wheat from the chaff when it comes to HSBC. Thank you so much for your time. That's Bloomberg's Jonathan Tice. I'm Caroline Hepke here in London.
And I'm Roger Hearing. You can catch us every weekday morning here for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 6 a.m. in London and 1 a.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
Thank you, Caroline and Roger. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, Facebook goes head-to-head with the IRS. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live to New York, Bloomberg 1130, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Radio Plus app and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak.
I'm Bob Moon in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. One of those stories surrounds Facebook. The social media giant will be in court next week to defend its practice of shifting profit to Ireland, where, surprise, corporate taxes are lower. And for an inside look at what to expect, Bloomberg's Sarah Friar from our San Francisco bureau joins us now. Sarah, welcome. What are we expecting to see go down when Facebook appears in court in Washington next Tuesday?
Well, of course, Facebook is going to say that all of its practices were legal and above board. And at the time, they say in their statement to me, they were an underdog. They were a much more uncertain business in a time of near death at any moment, as many startups are. And they needed to do this in order to do what others in the industry had done, like Google and Apple and Amazon. But as we've seen in the recent era, that doesn't necessarily make it better. The government is still going to come after you if you do the same bad things as every other company. Not to say that it's bad, but if they do lose this case, they're looking at a $9 billion liability.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand that argument, that at the time, this is what everybody was doing, clawing their way to survive. How does that justify the argument?
Well, the argument is that this is just best practices in legal at the time, and this is something that they did after there's a ProPublica article out that uses a lot of internal documents that look at communication between Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg and her subordinates, and she's advising Facebook to do the same exact thing that she did when she was at Google. So it was really just the way to save money. They were behind their peers in corporate tax profit parking in Ireland, and that's something that they needed to get done before their IPO to make their financials look a little better.
Now, this sounds like it's going to be quite a trial. 63 witnesses for Facebook?
It could last for weeks, even months. It starts on Tuesday in San Francisco and could move to D.C.
And how much is at stake again?
$9 billion.
That's what Facebook could have to pay if they're found to have violated the law?
Yes, and this is all from the year 2010. So this is there's a lot at issue about how exactly you value those assets at that time. Facebook was not a public company. So they're really going back in history here. I mean, to give you a sense of it, 2010 was 2 years before Facebook went public. And when it went public, they had a lot of turmoil in the markets for not knowing a business model for mobile advertising. And so it's really been a long time since then. However, the company is now, of course, one of the giants and open to a lot of scrutiny, the same as everyone else.
Yeah, it's hard to remember a day when Facebook was fighting to survive.
In 2010, they had only recently opened up to the general public. You know, at a certain point, Facebook was just for college students. So certainly a lot of history here. I mean, they were already clearly a giant back then, but it's interesting what we see companies end up dealing with once they do have power. The other thing I would note is the FTC is now looking back at acquisitions starting in 2010, not just for Facebook, but for Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, Google. They're looking at anti-competitive behavior starting in that year. So,
but that was the
really
way they did business back then as well, right?
Yeah, that was crucial to business to make acquisitions in order to ensure that you would keep your marketplace and clear out competition And now even the smaller acquisitions, the ones that were too low in value to trigger a review by the FTC are now under consideration by them to get a sense of the strategy, the whole picture, what happens when these companies are acquired.
I've got to ask you, though, when we talk about $9 billion, in the scheme of things today, what is $9 billion for Facebook?
It's not that significant. The company had about $70 billion in revenue last year, and they could certainly afford it if it were to come to pass. I mean, it's unlikely that it will be that high if they lose, but it's possible, and that's what they put in their securities filing.
And to go into some of the background on this, ProPublica, when it looked into this, found some memos that gave a light to how they arrived at this procedure?
Well, they found memos from Sheryl Sandberg telling her team that she felt when she came into the company in 2008 that they were behind the curve in dealing with taxes, that they were losing a lot of money by putting all of their tax revenue through the United States, where the rate is a lot higher.
Sarah Fryer, thank you very much for joining us. Great insight from Bloomberg reporter Sarah Fryer. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, the drama in the Democratic presidential primary. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Coming up, commodities with Joe Doe. But first, let's head to our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington for some insight into what's next in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. And for that, we bring in our Amy Morris.
Thank you, Bob. Iowa and New Hampshire in the history books now. The candidates look ahead now to Nevada and South Carolina. Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, and Amy Klobuchar came away big winners in New Hampshire, but there are still some variables to consider, like delegates. We want to learn all about this now from Bloomberg U.S. Politics editor Kathleen Hunter. It appears Buttigieg and Sanders at this point have the most delegates, and then Elizabeth Warren, Klobuchar, and Biden, they're all in single digits.
That's right. And so I think that, you know, New Hampshire seems to have had the effect that perhaps Iowa didn't, in the sense that it at least had some sort of a winnowing effect on the field. Now, the question is whether that winnowing effect holds true as we look forward to Nevada and South Carolina. And those are very different states from Iowa and New Hampshire. Iowa and New Hampshire traditionally have been states that are very connected to retail politics. They're very small states. So it's a lot of, you know, shaking hands and meeting individual voters. And they're also predominantly white states. You know, they have very small minority populations. So as we shift into the next round of caucuses and primaries in Nevada, and then following that a week later in South Carolina, Nevada is a state that has a large Hispanic population. South Carolina is a state where the majority of Democratic voters are African American. And so I think, you know, we could see some different candidates coming out on top in those states, and that could end up rejumbling the race.
Let's talk a little bit about those states, Iowa and New Hampshire, just for a second, because they're considered white, working class type states. Are you surprised that the former Vice President Biden is not getting more traction there?
In some ways, it is surprising because, you know, looking back to when Biden was added to the ticket with Obama, you know, that was part of Biden's perceived appeal, and Biden's actual appeal was to blue collar, you know, white working class blue collar voters. Mm-hmm. He hasn't been getting traction, as you say, with those voters so much this time around. And I don't know if that's necessarily a function of the field looking different or those voters evolving. Maybe perhaps some of those voters, we know Trump has really dipped into the support from some of those voters. But I think that it will be interesting, again, to look ahead to Nevada, because I think that's where there is an opportunity for Biden to start making some potential gains, you know, with particularly with Hispanic voters. And then again, in South Carolina, a week later, Biden does do very well with African-American voters. He tends to be the strongest there among the Democratic candidates. And so we could see, you know, I guess what I'm saying is don't count Biden out just yet.
I was going to ask, he does refer to South Carolina as his firewall, but what does he have to do to make sure he stays in the race? Does he have to win it all, or is coming in second or third in Nevada or South Carolina enough?
Well, I think when it comes to South Carolina in particular, I think a lot hinges on how he does in Nevada. But let's say he doesn't finish first in Nevada, then I think, you know, not having a first place finish in South Carolina could be really, a fatal blow to his campaign potentially, because all along, you know, his campaign has really been downplaying Iowa and New Hampshire. They didn't expect to win there. They didn't, I don't think, expect to do perhaps as poorly as they did. It wasn't, you know, a happy finish for them. But I think that all along they've been saying, you know, hold up. We weren't expecting to do well in these first two states, but we're going to turn it around in Nevada, South Carolina, and then on Super Tuesday, which is a very real possibility. But if that doesn't materialize, then the question is, you know, where is Biden's support?
Okay, let's turn to Elizabeth Warren now. Briefly, she has said all along that if she isn't the nominee, she's going to throw her support behind whomever that person is. She's been really clear on that point. Are all the other candidates on board with that, too?
Well, I guess I'd say the other candidates have been, I guess, less clear on that point. Okay. I think back to, you know, the 2016 campaign and, you know, the kind of protracted battle between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And I think, you know, a lot of folks think that protracted battle really did damage to Hillary Clinton in the general election. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's going to continue to be a real pressing question as this field gets winnowed, is not so much, you know, eventually whether everyone throws their support behind the nominee, but whether, you know, at what point that happens and if this ends up being more of a drawn-out fight than necessarily would be most strategic for Democrats.
Do you see her, if she doesn't perform well in Nevada, taking a powder? Do you see her leaving before South Carolina?
I think that's possible. I think it's very, very possible. I think that her finish particularly, I think it's more possible than I would have said, you know, before New Hampshire, given her finish there. But I think that, you know, looking ahead, it's really going to be important for her to perform well, just like it is for Biden, both in Nevada and in South Carolina. But I think in particular in Nevada, she has a real opportunity to perform well.
Right. And we do have a week of buildup before people cast their ballots in Nevada. Are you watching for anything in particular?
Well, I think that one of the key things to watch is, you know, Pete Buttigieg is someone who's really kind of caught fire in Iowa and New Hampshire. And so I think that it'll be very interesting to see, particularly, you know, whether or not he is able to broaden out his support to, you know, the Hispanic electorate in Nevada. I think that, you know, he's had a lot of issues with African-American voters. There could be some pushback both to him and also to Bernie Sanders. We were seeing this past week that there was some pushback from a union in Nevada to Bernie Sanders' candidacy. And so I think that, you know, they've kind of established themselves as perhaps even the top two right now. And I think that, you know, any indication of whether that's going to hold true given the different demographics in Nevada will be very interesting to watch this week.
Are these two primaries then, the ones that are coming up now, Nevada and South Carolina, they're kind of expected to make or break then the campaigns for Warren, Biden, and maybe even Klobuchar, who had something of a coming out party in New Hampshire?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like Klobuchar's star is a little bit on the rise. But I think, as you say, you know, for her, Biden and Warren, these next two contests are going to be very decisive. And, you know, if they're able, if any of them, you know, are able to achieve a first place finish or, you know, even a second place finish, I think that will be certainly enough to get them through to the next round on Super Tuesday. But I think that, you know, if that's not the case, then I think that it's going to be a lot more complicated for them to make the case that their campaign should continue.
Okay, we'll keep watching it. Thank you, Kathleen. That is Bloomberg U.S. Politics editor Kathleen Hunter, and that is what is happening in the nation's capital. I'm Amy Morris. You can catch more of our political coverage weekdays on Bloomberg Balance of Power from noon until 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. Bob.
Amy Morris from the Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington. Thank you, Amy. And now we turn to one of the exciting headlines impacting the commodity space, BP's crusade to stamp out carbon emissions. And for more on what it means for oil prices, let's bring in Bloomberg's Joe Doe.
Bob, oil companies, like most other industries, have responded to their investors by adopting targets to reduce emissions. But BP's new boss, Bernard Looney, is pledging to eliminate them almost completely. Energy reporter Laura Hirsch joins me to discuss this wild plan. I mean, this seems almost like an existential crisis of the oil industry. I mean, what is he really saying moving ahead for oil companies?
He's really departing from the traditional oil and gas business that BP is so steeped in. Going forward, the company will be producing less oil and gas. It really just shows that big oil is at a crossroads right now and that they have to change in order to survive.
So all the people you talk to in this industry, they hear this announcement. I mean, what is it? What is the biggest question on their minds right now after hearing this?
Well, the biggest question is, how are they going to do this? You know, it's a very ambitious plan, but they're very thin on details. In the presentation, Looney actually admitted, look, we don't have any milestones or near-term targets. So we know that this ambition is going to include carbon capture storage technology, that there'll be more investment in renewables, but we don't know the nitty-gritty of it.
Yeah, I mean, do investors just leave the company because this, you know, this just says it all, or is there something more that investors are wanting out of this?
Well, it's a mix. You definitely have a certain type of investor that's been calling for companies like BP to move in this direction, but at the same time, you have a lot of investors that are saying, actually, what we want is to have a generous dividend, which is what they pay, and they're not that concerned about renewables. So it's really a mixed bag.
And what does this mean for the oil price going forward, right? I mean, this is an oil company, right? We're talking, you know, is the world of $100 oil done? I mean, is there no oil? You know, is the future no oil? I mean, what are people really asking what this means for the price ahead?
Well, funnily enough, yesterday Looney did say it's a fool's game to try to predict the price. What he did also say is that actually there's going to be increased demand, you know, from emerging markets and so on. So there's still going to be demand for oil. However, it's just going to be a bigger mix going forward.
It seems like quite a juggling act. I mean, do investors think he can pull this off?
He claims he can. He said under no uncertain terms that they will reduce the debt, you know, pay out their dividend and move into the energy transition. But there's still a lot of questions about how he's going to do this. So he's going to have an investor day in September where I think a lot of people are going to be paying attention to actual details and milestones,
right,
to see how they can actually achieve this.
Yeah, and I mean, aren't a lot of these people going to say, well, we're already sitting with an oil glut?
Yes, that is true. And also, it's the demand right now is not great, especially with what's happening in Asia with the coronavirus. But, hey, we've seen super cycles before, so you never know how long this is going to last for. And more importantly, if and when we get through another super cycle where oil prices hit 100, are they going to be tempted to go down that route again?
That's one of the stories we're watching in Commodities for the Week Ahead. From New York, I'm Joe Doe. Bob?
Thank you, Joe. That was Bloomberg's Joe Doe. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday morning at 5 Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.